This is VOA News. I'm Tommy McNeil. The Israeli army released a video Tuesday showing what is said to be the tunnel in which the six hostages whose bodies were recovered were staying and killed there.
The tunnel shaft was in a children's room, in a house. Those are the walls of this children's room with Snow White and Mickey Mouse on the wall.
Israeli military spokesperson Rear Admiral Daniel Hagari was seen in the video showing the tunnel and elements found in it, stating that all items are taken for forensic checks. The six hostages were killed on the night of August 29th, according to Hagari. Their bodies were found and retrieved by Israeli soldiers in the southern Gaza area of Rafah around 2 days later. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken on Thursday accused Iran of sending ballistic missiles to Russia, which he said Moscow will likely use in Ukraine within weeks. Reuters correspondent Freddie Joyner.
His comments came during a joint news conference in London Tuesday with Britain's Foreign Secretary David Lammy. The two are set to visit Kyiv together in a joint trip, the first of its kind in over a decade. Blinken also said Washington privately warned Iran against sending missiles to Russia and that new sanctions would be imposed.
This gives the Russians an additional capability and it gives them additional flexibility. They have ballistic missiles already, but the particular Iranian missiles that they're getting have a certain range, so it adds to their capacity, and it fuels the war.
On Monday, a senior Iranian official denied reports Iran had supplied Russia with ballistic missiles.
Reuters' Freddie Joyner. Kamala Harris and Donald Trump showcased starkly different visions for the country on abortion, immigration, and American democracy as they met for the first time Tuesday for perhaps their only debate before November's presidential election. Already there are talks of a possibility of another debate before the election. This is VOA News. AP correspondent Norman Hall reports House Speaker Mike Johnson has pushed ahead on a funding bill that contains a proof of citizen mandate, despite him having prospects of its passage.
House Speaker Mike Johnson is vowing to press ahead with requiring proof of citizenship for new voters as part of a bill to avoid a partial government shutdown. Minnesota House Republican Tom Emmer charges that Democrats favor illegal voting by migrants.
Democrats would rather shut the government down then stop them from voting in federal elections.
But research shows that voting by non-citizens is extremely rare. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer says only a bipartisan measure without such proposals will pass.
The House should stop wasting time on a CR proposal that cannot become law.
Congress must pass some form of government funding legislation this month to avoid a partial shutdown starting in October. Norman Hall, Washington.
New York's September 11th Memorial Museum is preparing to host its annual remembrance ceremony on Wednesday, paying tribute to the victims of the deadliest terrorist attack in human history. AP correspondent Julie Walker reporting.
The centerpiece of the 9/11 Memorial in New York City is two reflecting pools with the names of the almost 3,000 people killed that day in 2001 etched into the sides. That's where the commemoration ceremony takes place.
We go into this with a sense of the importance of what we're doing because it's been reinforced over the years by so many family members and members of the 9/11 community.
That's Clifford Channon, director of the 9/11 Memorial, speaking about how family members will spend about 4 hours reading those names.
The dignity that they deserve.
Memorials will also take place at the Pentagon and in Shanksville, Pennsylvania. Julie Walker, New York.
Cameroon's former prime minister took over the presidency of the UN General Assembly on Tuesday, issuing a clarion call to the world-divided nations to come together and take action to address global challenges from climate change and poverty to conflicts and armed violence. Philemon Yang told the 193-member world body there are doubts that nations can join forces to tackle these and other pressing issues, but he said we must demonstrate that international cooperation remains the most effective tool at our disposal for addressing the profound and borderless issues we confront. Pope Francis is heading to Singapore for the final leg of his Asian trip. Francis ended his visit to East Timor with a rally on Wednesday morning of young people who make up the majority of the country's 1.3 million population. He urged them to work together to build their young country using the foundations of older generations who secured their independence from Indonesia. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barkey, Washington. Today is Wednesday, September 11th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Vice President Kamala Harris and former President Donald Trump met last night for their first debate.
My plan is to give a $50,000 tax deduction to startups, small businesses, knowing they are part of the backbone of America's economy.
3 days of national mourning for students killed in the dormitory fire in Kenya comes to an end today, Wednesday. Rwanda on Tuesday broke ground for a Kigali Innovation City. The Pan-African Opposition Leader Solidarity Network condemns the abduction and the murder of a Tanzanian opposition member.
We condemn the act in the strongest way possible. This is not something you expect in a democratic country or a country that prides itself as democratic.
And African nations boost their gold reserves amid economic uncertainty. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Vice President Kamala Harris and former President Donald Trump clashed on Tuesday night at their first debate in the November presidential election. They cover many topics, including abortion, immigration, and the economy. Here is one exchange about the economy.
When it comes to the economy, do you believe Americans are better off than they were 4 years ago?
So I was raised as a middle-class kid. And I am actually the only person on this stage who has a plan that is about lifting up the middle class and working people of America. I believe in the ambition, the aspirations, the dreams of the American people. And that is why I imagine and have actually a plan to build what I call an opportunity economy. Because here's the thing. We know that we have a shortage of homes and housing, and the cost of housing is too expensive for far too many people. We know that young families need support to raise their children, and I intend on extending a tax cut for those families of $6,000, which is the largest child tax credit that we have given in a long time, so that those young families can afford to buy a crib, buy a car seat, buy clothes for their children. My passion, one of them, is small businesses. I was actually, my mother raised my sister and me, but there was a woman who helped raise us. We call her our second mother. She was a small business owner. I love our small businesses. My plan is to give a $50,000 tax deduction to startup small businesses, knowing they are part of the backbone of America's economy. My opponent, on the other hand, his plan is to do what he has done before, which is to provide a tax cut for billionaires and big corporations, which will result in $5 trillion to America's deficit. My opponent has a plan that I call the Trump's sales tax, which would be a 20% tax on everyday goods that you rely on to get through the month. Economists have said that that Trump sales tax would actually result for middle-class families in about $4,000 more a year, because of his policies and his ideas about what should be the backs of middle-class people paying for tax cuts for billionaires.
President Trump, I'll give you 2 minutes.
First of all, I have no sales tax. That's an incorrect statement. She knows that. We're doing tariffs on other countries. Other countries are going to finally, after 75 years, pay us back for all that we've done for the world. And the tariff will be substantial in some cases. I took in billions and billions of dollars, as you know, from China. In fact, they never took the tariff off because it was so much money they can't. It would totally destroy everything that they've set out to do. They're taking in billions of dollars from China and other places. They've left the tariffs on. When I had it, I had tariffs, and yet I had no inflation. Look, we've had a terrible economy because inflation has, which is really known as a country buster, it breaks up countries. We have inflation like very few people have ever seen before, probably the worst in our nation's history. We were at 21%, but that's being generous because many things are 50, 60, 70, and 80% higher than they were just a few years ago. This has been a disaster for people, for the middle class, but for every class. I created one of the greatest economies in the history of our country. I'll do it again and even better.
Former President Donald Trump and Vice President Kamala Harris speaking during their first debate Tuesday night. Joining us live from Washington, D.C. is Dr. Samuel Shihata, Professor of Middle East Studies at the University of Oklahoma. Good morning to you, Professor, and welcome to Daybreak Africa.
Thank you very much for having me. Well, coming into the debate, Professor, much had been said about the economy. How do you think both candidates handled the topic?
Well, clearly, Kamala Harris, in the clip that you played, had a vision for what she wants to do in the future. But as your listeners probably noticed, she didn't really answer the question as posed, which was, are you better off today than you were 4 years ago? And the question was really getting at the noticeable rise in inflation that many Americans have experienced over the last years, and the difficulty in some economic aspects of life. And so, you know, as often happens in these debates, the candidates answer questions that they want to answer rather than the questions that are posed. And so, yes, the economy has been and has always been the number one question on Americans' minds in this election and in previous elections. As one commentator, as President Clinton said many years ago in terms of how voters vote, he said, quote, it's the economy, stupid. And there was some discussion about the economy, of course, but unfortunately, it was, I believe, unsatisfactory. There weren't details, there weren't specifics, and there was a lot of about what people would do, plan, hypothetical plans, as opposed to analysis of what the situation is and has been over the last few years.
Abortion was also heavily featured, and by all indications, it is expected to be that way between now and Election Day. How do you think both sides dealt with that topic also?
Yes, certainly it is a very important question and is going to be a deciding factor for many American voters, particularly because of what has happened over the last few years. That is the overturning of the famous Roe versus Wade decision, which legalized abortion. And I believe that, of course, the Democrats and Kamala Harris, who are in favor of reinstating Roe versus Wade, and, of course, a woman's right to have sovereignty over her own body and to choose an abortion, I believe is a winning issue for her, and she forcefully addressed that question. But again, you know, there were false statements made by President Trump and also an unwillingness to answer specific questions on his part and also on her part when he asked her specific questions about whether she would allow abortion in the seventh or eighth month and so on. But nevertheless, she has a much more progressive answer with regard to this question. She is more in line with the American general sentiment about preserving the Roe versus Wade decision and allowing women the right to choose whether they decide to have an abortion or not. So I think that issue is one that favors her, certainly.
On foreign policy, Professor, the war in Ukraine and the Israel-Hamas conflict were center stage. Your comment?
Yes, again, you know, for I think for your listeners and for those who work on foreign policy, really, the Russia-Ukraine war, the war in Gaza between Israel and Hamas, but also the onslaught, the genocidal aggression of Israel on the civilian Palestinian population, and then the issue of China, really, in terms of economics, were really the three major foreign policy questions posed. I guess you could also add into that Mexico and South America and the question of illegal immigration and the border as a foreign policy and domestic policy issue that was addressed. And all of them, I believe, were not addressed adequately, not addressed intelligently. For example, on the question of the Russia-Ukraine war, it seemed like all Vice President Harris was saying was, we need to support Ukraine, we want Ukraine to win, we want to fund Ukraine, and accusing former President Trump of not doing that and caving to Vladimir Putin. On the same side, on the other side, President Trump didn't really provide specifics about his claim that, A, the war would never have happened if he was in office, or, B, he would end the war somehow in a short period of time. And so really questions of what's at stake, how to get to an end to the war, weren't addressed. Similarly, with regard to the Gaza war, it was deeply unsatisfactory. As usual, both candidates were falling over themselves, speaking about how much they support Israel and Israel's right to defend itself, with barely really any willingness to acknowledge even the legitimate rights of the Palestinians and the suffering that has been inflicted on them in Gaza and also in the West Bank. So I think foreign policy wasn't really addressed sufficiently. That isn't surprising because, as you mentioned and as is the case, domestic politics are really the most important drivers of how Americans vote in elections, with the caveat that because of the ongoing war in Gaza, as we've noticed over the last year or so in this country, there have been major protests on college campuses and so on to protest American support for Israel in the war. And so that might be an issue that impacts, you know, hundreds of thousands, if not millions of voters, Arab American, Muslim American voters, students who are very concerned about this issue and American complicity in the killing of tens of thousands of Palestinians in Gaza.
Professor, we thank you very much again for joining us this morning. Thank you very much.
You're very welcome. My pleasure, James.
That was Professor Samia Shihata, a professor of Middle East Studies at the University of Oklahoma, speaking with us live from Washington, D.C. You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Wednesday, September 11th. For more African news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. The Pan-African Opposition Leaders Solidarity Network has expressed a deep concern about the abduction and murder of a member of Tanzania's main opposition, Chadema Party. Mohamed Ali Kibayo was abducted on September 6th, and his body was found in a Dar es Salaam neighborhood. Tanzania President Samia Suluhu Hassan has ordered the country's investigative agencies to give her a thorough report about Kibayo's death. The U.S. Embassy in Tanzania has called for an independent, transparent, and swift investigation. Martha Karua is the leader of the National Rainbow Coalition, Kenya. She tells me that the development in Tanzania sends a wrong message about democracy in East Africa.
It's with great shock and consternation, and we condemn the acts in the strongest way possible. Credible reports indicate he was abducted from a bus by people who, by all appearances, were police, only later to be found tortured and murdered. This is not something you expect in a democratic country or a country that prides itself as democratic. And you know Tanzania is privileged to host the African Commission on Human and People's Rights and the court. It's also hosting the East Africa Court of Justice. And it is a democracy.
President Samia Suluhu Hassan has ordered an investigation. Are you pleased with what she's done so far?
I think it would be better if he followed the request of Chadema, the opposition, that he should open a commission of inquiry, a judicial commission. The police cannot investigate themselves. If they are suspected to have abducted the deceased from the bus he was in, how then will they investigate? Tanzania is going to have elections in December, municipal elections, and then general elections next year. And one wonders whether this is connected to the competition between the ruling party and the opposition. And this does not augur well for democracy in Tanzania, in East Africa, because it looks like now all the countries are not doing well in democracy.
This Pan-African Opposition Solidarity Network includes your country, Kenya, Burundi, Tanzania, Uganda, And so how would you describe the state of the opposition in your country and the other countries?
Tanzania, the opposition has been doing well, but this setback by intimidation, harassment, and now murder is a great setback. In Kenya, the opposition has been decimated by the ruling party, by the partnership between Raila's ODM and the KK government, where the ODM have one leg in government and another leg in opposition. So by now pretending to be in both spaces, what is happening is that they are sitting on positions that need to be with a party not in government. And when you look at Burundi, government there raided the opposition party and instigated a faction taking over and deregistering the legitimate opposition leader. So there's a pattern in East Africa of government not tolerating dissent, not tolerating hearing alternative voices, and going against the constitution to stop all manner of unlawful maneuvers like in Burundi. In Uganda, every now and then, Bobi Wine and his party are being harassed by the government. Besigye and his party are being harassed. So the opposition is under serious harassment in all East African states, I would say.
Martha Karua is the leader of the National Rainbow Coalition Kenya opposition party. She was speaking with us from Nairobi. 3 days of national mourning declared by President William Ruto for students killed last week in a dormitory fire in Kenya comes to an end today, Wednesday. 21 students said that those to have been died, to have died. The government has urged parents and people living near the privately owned school to help account for all the boys. Akello Misuri is the Secretary General of the Kenya Union of Post-Primary Education Teachers. He told me that the government must ensure the strict enforcement of school safety and rules and regulations.
It is unfortunate that the school fires usually occur, but unfortunately, this particular time, this one occurred in a school in the central part of Kenya, and it affected those learners in the boarding private primary school, which is next to Nyeri town. It is unfortunate that quite a number of children, in fact, so far, about 21 of them have lost their lives. Some of them are not accounted for because there are others who got burnt beyond recognition, and it is so unfortunate. But one issue which disturbs every Kenyan is that we have had a lot of school safety rules, regulations, a lot of research conducted, observations and recommendations done about school safety, and the policy formulators, especially the Ministry of Education, has taken very little to avert such kind of incidences or accidents in schools.
What do you think the Ministry of Education could have done?
You know, one of the issues is around, did they adhere to safety regulations, and were they conducting the normal safety standards as required by the regulations? Because since 2018, we have had previously fires, and so many reports have been written about how to make our schools safe. But it appears that all those reports gather more at the cells of the Ministry of Education. There is very limited investment in terms of quality assurance and standards, and those who are tasked with the responsibility to monitor all those issues related to safety regulations have not taken part adequately. That is the responsibility of the minister.
So as the mourning period comes to an end, have they found whether anyone was responsible for the fires?
The investigations are still on, and it is still early to speculate on the nature, because the entire place is under security, and criminal investigators and all those government agencies are camped there to identify pieces of evidence which will show lead into what probably caused the fire. and therefore it is too early to make any conclusions on what actually took place. But because a majority of the learners in this kind of institution were between the age 9 and 13, those are very young ones, and it appears that there was no credible person responsible on site to give information at the time you are making this call.
Akello Misuri is the Secretary General of the Kenya Union of Post-Primary Education Teachers. He was speaking with me from Nairobi. Rwanda on Tuesday broke ground for the Kigali Innovation City. The U.S. $2 billion project aims to transform Rwanda into Africa's leading technology and innovation hub. According to the Rwanda government, Kigali Innovation City will seek to facilitate the development of pan-African talent and act as a technology innovation hub. For more on this development, VOA's Douglas Mpuga reached Paula Ngabiri, Rwanda's Minister of Information and Communication Technology and Innovation.
The groundbreaking ceremony that we had today is an exciting milestone that we achieved as we seek to start the construction of the first innovation building. But it's important to also note that there's already been existing companies within the Kigali Innovation City. We have the Carnegie Mellon University, Africa Campus, that is present within the Kigali Innovation City. It's been 5 years now. We have the African Leadership University and the University of Rwanda, their medical engineering center. So today we did the groundbreaking and we'll be setting up the first innovation building that will host different companies that will be part of this innovation ecosystem. But more broadly, the city is going to be a mixed-use, both office spaces, student housing, universities, science museums, and hotels as well. And so it will be really this where we're able to have a work-life balance for the community that is best within the innovation city.
So who is financing this apart from the Rwanda government, and what do you hope to achieve at the end when it's complete?
So we have a couple of partners on board. One of them is Africa 50, which is AFCB's infrastructure investment arm. And so we have we created a joint venture, a special purpose vehicle through which they are making the investments to put up the opportunities that we've already designed for. We've finished the architectural design, the master planning, and so the Kigali Innovation City, the Africa 50 will be investing in this, and we'll be working together to mobilize more partners. We also have Badea, that is coming in to also support on what we call the horizontal infrastructure, the utilities, roads, and everything, and they've already started the work. As we launch the first building, we will be working with Africa 50 to mobilize more financial funding partners that will come on board to realize different components of the Kigali Innovation City. And once it's complete, it will be a space that has all the facilities I mentioned, and with a full ecosystem of entrepreneurs, startups, multinational companies that are co-located within the same space.
No, we're looking forward to really accelerating this progress, but also welcoming startups and companies that are looking to find a place where they can innovate, where they can test their ideas. Rwanda is a proof of concept hub. So it's really a whole of the system effort. What we launched today was the physical infrastructure, but around it are all these other components that are so crucial to growing and, you know, an innovation ecosystem. And we welcome startups from across the world, multinational tech companies, entrepreneurs to come and consider Rwanda as their home and space to innovate and create ideas that will change the world.
Paula Ngabiri is Rwanda's Minister of Information, Communication Technology and Innovation. She spoke from the capital, Kigali, with my colleague, Douglas Mpuga. And that's it for this Wednesday, September 11th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for coming aboard with us this morning. For more African news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. We are also on YouTube, where you can watch our TV shows, Africa 54, Straight Talk Africa, and Red Carpet. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, I'm James Barton in Washington, wishing that you will have a lovely day.